It's Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. My name's Marcus Costello, and this week we're doing things a bit differently. I caught up with Associate Professor Faye Anderson, lecturer in the School of Media, Film and Journalism at Monash University, and co-author of Shooting the Picture, Press Photography in Australia. Faye and her colleague Sally Young interviewed 60 past and present press photographers to write a history of Australian press photography. The book charts political leaders and campaigns, crime, war, celebrity censorship and more, and maps the technological and commercial evolution in the industry. I started by asking Faye, what was it like in the very early days, in the late 1800s, when photography made its way from science to art to newspapers?
The first photographs were to illustrate, and they were never there to illustrate the news in the early years. They were simply there, you know, it was a separate picture. And they were illustrated magazines. They weren't even the newspapers. Really, the first newspaper photograph was published in 1908. And then from the 1920s with the pictorial newspapers, so this the Sun, pictorial newspaper in Melbourne, the Daily Telegraph here, they started to publish photographs, and the tabloids used them in a far more strategic way. Even in those years, they'd figured out the power of a photograph very early on. The broadsheets thought they were photographs were tabloid, so they didn't actually use them very effectively until the 1950s.
So you're saying the broadsheets kind of looked down their nose?
Yeah, they did. They thought it was sort of a tabloid. They didn't think it would revolutionise the industry. They didn't really see the evidential power of a photograph. So it was a very long trajectory. We think of newspapers, or if we think about newspapers at all, and that's a whole different story, as, you know, the illustration is so important. But they were there actually as decoration rather than anything else. So when I write about the Titanic, which is in 1912 and it sunk, you know, you would think that was front page, huge news. But really, newspapers still had advertising for the first eight pages. So they didn't even have a front page. So a photograph of the Titanic was embedded in page eight, I think. And it took about 2 days for them, you know, to have the photograph on file. So
when editors came around to using photos in the newspaper, how did that change the way that copy was written?
Well, again, that's a very slow trajectory. So we expect it doesn't happen instantly. So they often don't have the story next to a picture. Sometimes they did. So the Daily Telegraph, when they covered the Claude Tozer criminal trial in 1921, which is a very, I write about it and we have the photograph, it's a very, very violent crime scene of Claude Tozer, who was a cricket player and a World War One hero, as he was pitched, who'd had an affair with one of his patients. He was a medical practitioner, and she'd shot him three times. And they published the photograph of him dead on a sofa with the bullet wounds, which surprised me. And I still think it's probably the most violent domestic photograph that we have, or one of them. And they did illustrate it. The Daily Telegraph, I think that they were trying to figure out the boundaries of violent photograph. How do you use a violent photograph? So they did put it in the story, but usually you can see a photograph that is not actually part of the story. And look, until the 1980s even, the photographers we interviewed, and we interviewed 60 of them, some of them still railed that journalists thought of them simply as illustrators to the story rather than it was picture driven. It was always print driven. And there was still that sort of conflict about that power and the individual singular power of the photograph leading the story rather than the other way around.
That's interesting that you say that that photograph taken over 100 years ago to this day might just be the most violent image to have made it into print.
Domestic.
How did they negotiate what was acceptable for public consumption?
The final arbiter, the final sort of person who makes any decision, is the editor. Under the editor is the picture editor, who takes the photographs that the photographers have given them, and then, I mean, now it's filed, so it's a very different process. The photographer, actually, his agency and her agency is taking the image, you know, the decision whether they take that image. And honestly, for most photographers, the ethical ones and the unethical ones, it's a moment, you know, you often have people saying, how could they take that photograph? But really, they are there to take the picture, as they would say it. So it depends on the editor what photographs they really want to put in. And it's sometimes changed. There seems to have been rules when we wrote this book. So for an Australian soldier, we have never had a dead Australian soldier published in a newspaper at the time that they were killed. It's just off limits. You just won't see it. You can see a dead American, you can see the dead other, the dead enemy, certainly, but you can't see an Australian. For crime, it's a little bit different, and it really does depend on the editor. And we had a couple. There was a case of two men that killed two police officers, and Michael Gawenda was the editor of The Age, and Jason South took the photograph. And it's a very distant photograph of one of the victims with a sheet over, but you can see the blood. And it was a colour photograph. And they decided that it was responsible to publish that photograph, and I'm inclined to agree with them, because it shows what police do in the field. It did. There was a huge backlash, and it went to the press council. The police complained, and it went to the press council. So the press council now, and I think since the 1980s, I could be wrong about the date, they decide, you know, they make a judgment about whether they think it's responsible or not. And it's often decided on public interest. That's the expression they use all the time, which, of course, is fairly nebulous. You know, your idea of public interest and my idea of public interest could be very different. But that's what it's down to. So if it's public interest, they'll say, yeah, we can publish it.
One thing that really struck me was the evolution of, quote unquote, setting up a photo. Can you talk me through what that process is and sure. how it's changed over time?
Right. So it was a highly valued skill that you would stage a photograph. So early on, and even now, you know, even a photo op is a staged photograph, if you think about it. You're not necessarily moving things, but it's a setup in a way. So it was a highly valued sort of skill. And there's a number of things to differentiate. You've got staging, where you're asking someone to stand there, what photographers and journalists will call a grip and grin, where someone's shaking a hand and grinning. You know, they have all sorts of lexicons and expressions. But then you've got manipulation. That's a different issue altogether. But for staging, some of those older photographs, if you put a teddy bear, for example, in a cyclone, a war zone, it's an old trope. It's a terrible cliche. They did it all the time. They move people. They move cars. It was a highly valued skill. And, you know, the photographers would talk about great photographers because they had that imagination, that they had that eye. Now, of course, the younger photographers are very critical of that. Now, as I said, it's very different from manipulation, but they're really critical and they think it looks a bit old-fashioned and they wouldn't necessarily do it. That said, one of the photographers said that he'd noticed a photographer moving a book near Bill Shorten as he was leaving one of the election campaign places, and I can't remember what the book was called, but it was one of those gotcha moments. You know, having a politician under reject, the sign reject, is something, you know, all photographers were looking at. That's not staging. But now, of course, you have all these assistants and advisors saying, you know, they go out there to scout that there's nothing going to be embarrassing for their politicians.
We had an interesting discussion on this show earlier in the year during the election campaign with BuzzFeed's political editor, Mark DeStefano, talking about what it was like on the campaign trail. And he said that essentially the trail was set up for photographers and for videographers who need their grabs for the 6 o'clock news. Everything pivoted around those photogenic moments.
Yeah, the only thing is, of course, as long as it's not going to humiliate them. And, I mean, if you go back to the 1960s with Kennedy, he had his own photographer. He understood the power of a photographer. Tony Abbott appointed his own photographer before he was ousted. Although there's more, you know, they want photographers to take photos, they also want to sanitize it and make sure that there aren't those gotcha moments, you know, with a sign that says out or,
That's really interesting that a politician would have their own photographer. As you say, you can sanitize it, you can control the message.
You know, football teams. So every football team has a photographer usually now. The Australian Defence Force has their own image archive with thousands and thousands of photographs that anyone can sort of download, and newspapers do it all the time. With the diminution of newspapers, with 3/4 of staff photographers gone, it's the cheapest and easiest way, and it's a way of controlling the message, and the newspapers take the images.
At this year's Republican National Convention, BuzzFeed launched BuzzBot. It's an automated chatbot for Facebook's Messenger app. The bot allowed basically anyone at the convention to send through their impressions via Facebook Messenger, and then the bot responds in this sort of back and forth. Are you seeing that media outlets are starting to crowdsource photography in that way?
Well, they do it. They do it in a number of ways. They have journalists now that they've armed them with iPhones, so they're pretty boring photographs, I have to say. So,
as opposed to having a staff
photographer. So yep. They have. So for the crime photographs, which I look at a lot, you know, you'll have a journo just doing that blue and white tape, which is just saying I'm there. It says nothing about a story. There's no skill to it. It's just having someone there. It's a very cheap way. We didn't see that a lot of the newspapers still used citizen journalism in inverted commas. I mean, the question about that is ethics, you know, and why they're taking the photographs. How do you know, for example, that Trump's people aren't taking the most ludicrous photographs, and vice versa, if the Clinton machine are doing the same thing? So, and they don't subscribe to the MEA ethics in Australia if they're using citizen photographers. So there is a problem, but it's a very cheap option. And that's the reality of newspapers. The business model is just disintegrating. All the photographers are there on the spot. They're actually seeing what's going on. So, you know, they tell you things off the record, and sometimes they don't know, but, you know, they're very close to the police. The media are very close to the police, so they're actually often fed a lot of information. But, yeah, the photographers actually have to go out in the field. And now they, you know, once upon a time they used to go with the journalists, so they'd have someone with them. Not that they needed help, you know, they drove a lot of those pictures, but it makes them far more vulnerable. They're much closer to danger. They're much closer to very high volatile stories. They often have to deal with highly traumatized people, or just malevolence, you know, people that are just horrible.
So what was your favorite story, the most shocking, controversial, memorable story that
I can
you
tell?
Have from researching this book? Yeah.
So in terms of those stories, there were so many. There were stories about people forgetting what they covered. We had one photographer, Rick Stevens, who is an amazing photographer. He couldn't remember he'd done Snowtown. Now, he'd done so many assignments, but he'd suppressed it. It had been so horrific. And he'd also done Port Arthur. We had one photographer, Clive McKinnon, who talked about the revolutionary aspect of digital photography, and he said he covered horse racing for 30 years, and until he'd seen a digital photograph, he didn't realise horses had eyelashes, which is just a beautiful way of expressing that absolute vivid quality of the new cameras. Some of the photographers were more resistant to it. There were stories of sexual harassment for the women, and the story of gender and gender politics was pretty interesting and very and vital.
Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. So women.
So when did women become part of the industry?
We interviewed pioneers, and they came in very late. And, you know, we often say, you know, there weren't that many women. There were women freelancers. Adelaide Hurley, she worked freelance.
What years are these?
Well, I think the first couple emerged during the Second World War, but they weren't accredited and they weren't staff photographers. The first female, the first woman cadet journalist was Yvette Grady for the Australian newspaper in 1965. Yep, it gets sort of worse and better in a way. Laurie Graham was the first Fairfax in 1975, and Laurie is still an extraordinary freelance photographer. And she said to us she was only appointed because it was the International Women's Year, and Fairfax felt that they needed to appoint a woman. And I think the secretary suggested that.
And why did it take so long?
It's a very blokey, I would say sometimes misogynistic industry. They blamed the weight of equipment, but it was a form of exclusion.
In the physical.
Yeah, and it was, but honestly, the women could carry it. I think that was an excuse. Every single photographer I interviewed, and I interviewed 30 of them, all said it was blokey. That was the word they used. It was tough. It was blokey. It was really difficult for the women to navigate. And for those early pioneers, even when we interviewed some of the only a couple, they would still... Their feelings about women photographers were slightly betrayed. You know, they'd still, one of them said, oh, they didn't quite cut it. And, you know, and then you'd have someone like Mike Bowers, who was the former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. And he said he could never understand the attitude, because every female photographer he worked with, he said they were all fantastic. And Mike chose Kate Geraghty as the first female Fairfax photographer to cover a war in 2003. So we're talking about a woman, and Kate's done momentous work and is probably our most seasoned conflict photographer. 2003, the first Walkley winner who was a female was Verity Chambers, and that was in 1992. So it's, yeah, it was for the women, it was a very difficult career to navigate.
So in the past few years, we've seen some pretty incredible composite photography, that is, photoshopped, manipulated Sure. images on the front pages of the biggest tabloids. So does the old saying, the camera never lies, still have currency?
The camera's always lied. and it's about us as viewers. We're very subjective. We read what we want to read in a photograph. Again, look, the media has a very short institutional memory. The military has a very long one, but the media tend to have a very short one. Frank Hurley, who I mentioned before, he did composite photographs in World War One. He used 12 images over each other and they're beautiful photographs, but he believed photography was art, not a historical evidence. So it also depends on their imperative. It's much easier now. It's also, for some news organisations, instant dismissal. AP instantly dismissed a photographer that had manipulated an image, you know, putting smoke in, all sorts of reasons. But my feeling is, of course, photographs lie. They're sometimes our closest things to evidence, and I think World War II and the liberation of the concentration camps and those extraordinary photos that came out that were really important. And Ike Eisenhower said, take all the photographs that we need to, because this is proof this is happening. And it was. But in terms of those photographs that we see that are manipulated, whether it's Tony Abbott and the Daily Telegraph and the way the Daily Telegraph editorialises with photographs, they tend to say that it has been manipulated. But
I think that's only come in as a ruling very recently, yeah, hasn't it? That if there's been after the fact manipulation, it has to state underneath the image that this is a composite.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most photographers don't do it. And I have to say, the ones we interviewed, they were really, you know, they're usually very ethical, and particularly the ones they've been in the game for a very long time. That's why actually a lot of them don't like citizen photography, because they really don't know what the provenance is. They don't know what people have done with an image. But it can both lie, but saying that, it's also an extraordinarily crucial idea about, you know, this is our evidence, this is proof these things are happening. And in countries where, you know, photographers can't get in, like Syria, the photograph is very, very important, because we are seeing suffering that we wouldn't see. Similarly, with the liberation of the concentration camps, the most assiduous chronicles of their criminal intent were the Nazis. They took photographs all the time. They just weren't picked up by the news agencies because, for whatever reason, they tended to either discount it or they were concentrating on other things. So the camera is very, very important.
Some of the biggest stories coming out of Syria in the last few years have been centered around photographs, especially of the couple of children
that we've seen. Yeah. But that said, Marcus, the important thing to remember about those photographs, look, there's been a couple. There were the photographs from Syria. There was that amazing photograph of the woman in America where the Black Lives Matter, where she's standing in front of a group of guards.
In Baton Rouge.
Yeah. That said, all those photographs are ironically or not ironically taken by professional photographers. So because, you know, they can take a beautiful shot, they're creative, they know how to take a photograph, how to take a great photograph. I mean, the citizen photographers, they come into their own, particularly the London bombings, for example. A lot of those images came from people on the ground. So, you know, it's not one or the other. I think what is really opportune is that we actually have all sorts of diverse sources, and I think that's important. But the crucial issue is not to actually just get rid of the professional photographers, which a lot of the news organisations are slowly doing.
With so much changing, with so much evolution, what has stayed the same about press photography? Has anything stayed constant?
That's a good question. Look, I think a extraordinary image that grabs our attention, that captures our collective memory, I think that's unchanged. I think why photographs capture our attention are different. That said, we have so many images. So in 2014, 1.8 billion images were downloaded in that year. So we have so many images, whether we remember them the way we used to, that goes to the change as well. But I think the power of a photograph, the beauty of a photograph, the skill of a photographer, I don't think that will ever go. In terms of the history of newspaper photographers, staff photographers, that's a moving feast, and it's not necessarily going to end well, I don't think. It depends, you know, we spoke to, as I said, a lot of the photographers, and many of them lamented what was happening. Others, some were a little bit optimistic because they believe that, you know, it will always survive. It will always survive. Photojournalism will. But, you know, we can't predict. And we started this project 3 years ago, and I don't think I realised, you know, that we were walking into people's lives at, you know, often their most vulnerable. You know, we started with 60 and 10 took voluntary redundancies or had been let go over that period. So, you know, you'd walk into people's lives, and we had one after we turned off the machine, the audio machine, she asked us if we knew what was going on in terms of her news organisation. And then 6 months later, she wasn't working for the newspaper. So it's changed so dramatically, and it always has. And look, critics have always lamented what they imagine is the demise of photojournalism. They did it in the 1970s when Life magazine ceased to be a weekly newspaper magazine. So it's that thing about, oh, it's gone. And of course it hadn't gone. It's just different. It's a different being. But I think that power, I think, you know, we all get drawn to photographs for different reasons. But sometimes they can capture a moment. Sometimes they can capture an era. You know, if you go look at the Vietnam photographs, if you look at World War II photographs, you know, there are reasons why they've lasted.
Faye Anderson, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
That was Faye Anderson, co-author of Shooting the Picture, Press Photography in Australia, published by Melbourne University Press and available in stores and online. Well, that's it for Fourth Estate this week, but we're on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, so you can listen to this episode and every other episode of Fourth Estate anytime, anywhere.